not only incitement by the Israeli police, but they're also trying to silence voices that are coming from Israeli journalism, voices who are criticizing the actions of the Israeli government and the Israeli police. Not only that,
the Israeli police... We have 5 seconds, police, Rami.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say that the Israeli police are not telling the whole truth. If you confront them with the evidence, they're basically going to call you a liar.
We're going to do part two with you and post online at democracynow.org and play a clip of that interview you did. Rami Yunus. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. The Oregon Health Authority updates mask guidelines for people who are fully vaccinated. State officials hire an independent consultant to review their controversial hazardous tree removal program. And in international news, Israeli jets continue to hit Gaza as Palestinians take to the streets in protest. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 18th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Here's a reminder that special election ballots in Oregon must be dropped off at a drop box tonight, Tuesday, May 18th, by 8 p.m. You can find a drop box near you by visiting sos.oregon.gov. The May 18th special district election will vary county by county, so not all ballots look the same. Depending on where you live in Multnomah County, you'll have the chance to vote on a candidate to represent you on the Portland Public Schools Board or one of the other local district boards like David Douglas, Park Rose, Beaverton, Riverdale, Corbett, or Gresham Barlow. All Multnomah County residents can vote for candidates for the Multnomah Education Service District Board, a kind of super school board that coordinates between the different school districts in the county. Depending on where you live, you may be asked to vote on candidates for either the Portland Community College Board or the Mount Hood Community College Board. There are also a handful of races for fire and water districts for those who live on the outskirts of the county. Portland voters also have just one ballot measure to consider, the renewal of a 5-year funding levy for the Oregon Historical Society, which operates a museum and library focused on the state's history. The measure does not create any new fees, rather it is an extension of an existing levy. People are generally less aware of special elections, so voter turnout does not reach the same magnitude as it does in general elections. Election officials are estimating there will be about a 20% turnout. Special election ballots must be dropped off at a drop box tonight, Tuesday, May 18th, by 8 p.m. You can find a drop box near you by visiting sos.oregon.gov. The final results of the election will be certified on June 7th. The Oregon Health Authority reported 310 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 195,882. Oregon health officials also reported 3 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 2,590. There are currently 342 people hospitalized statewide, including 81 patients in intensive care units. So far, more than 62% of the state's eligible population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with more than 40% fully vaccinated. Governor Kate Brown said she will lift restrictions when 70% of the state's eligible population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Once individual counties reach 65% vaccinated, they can move into the lower-risk COVID-19 classification level. Benton and Hood River have already reached that threshold, while Multnomah County needs only 313 people to receive their first dose to reach 65%. On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority announced new mask guidelines for people who are fully vaccinated. Those who are fully vaccinated will no longer be required to wear a mask in most indoor settings, but only where vaccination status is checked. Under the updated guidelines, businesses, employers, and religious institutions can determine their own mask policies. They can choose to no longer require masks, but they will then have to require people show proof of vaccination. Someone is considered fully vaccinated 2 weeks after the single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine or 2 weeks after their second dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna 2-series vaccination. State health officials also announced that masks are no longer required outdoors, regardless of vaccination status. However, OHA recommends that people who are not vaccinated and who are at high risk of severe COVID-19 continue to wear masks and socially distance. Nationally, the U.S. has reported almost 33 million cases of COVID-19. At least 585,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 32,000 new cases per day, a decrease of 35% from the average 2 weeks earlier. So far, more than 48% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 37% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 163.6 million people in nearly every country. At least 3.3 million people have died across the world. The FBI has assigned agents to assist Portland police in responding to suspected gang-related shootings in the metro area. For more, we go to KBOO's Al Kahn.
The FBI has assigned 3 agents to respond along with Portland police to any suspected gang-related shootings due to a sharp increase in gun-related violence in the metro area. The agents are part of the FBI's Metro Safe Streets Task Force and have been teamed with 8 Portland police officers to respond to every shooting over the past weekend after 3 suspected gang-related shooting deaths last week. The agent in charge of the task force, Karen Ramsey, hopes that the agents responding with local police officers will result in a more swift gathering of leads on who may be responsible, and has vocalized concerns raised from street-level word of mouth and social media that people may be coming in from out of state to engage in violence. Speculation of out-of-state agitators began after the shooting of Jaylon Yoakum, who is the stepson of anti-violence advocate Pastor Matt Hennessy. Jaylon was followed and killed in the parking lot of a food cart pod near 118th and Sandy Boulevard last Wednesday. This was followed only hours later in another suspected targeted killing near Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Deakum Street, where 25-year-old Diane Williams was killed along with an unidentified man who was shot in the head. 3 days earlier, another unidentified person was killed near Southeast 85th and Harney Street, which also appears to be gang-related. Mayor Ted Wheeler, along with the City Council, issued a statement last Friday announcing the increased police presence and the FBI's involvement, which described information that unspecified groups reportedly issued an order to shoot someone for the next 30 days or be shot for not showing loyalty. Also noted in the statement, vigils and funerals for shooting victims are, quote, credible targets for future violence, end quote, which seems to be the case last night as a group of people who had attended a funeral for a shooting victim met at a McDonald's on Swan Island, where they were fired on, injuring 4 people. A large crowd showed up at Legacy Emmanuel Hospital where the victims were taken, which caused a police response to provide a presence and keep order, as several arguments and fights sprang up. Dozens of police cars from all over the city filled the parking lot, and officers blocked the emergency room doors. Police have not commented if any arrests were made or if there were any suspects in the shooting, but it has been reported that at least 50 shots were fired at the scene on Swan Island. Agent Ramsey said that he doesn't expect significant change to happen overnight, and a greater impact will only be felt as cases are built and those responsible are arrested and prosecuted. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
Oregon state officials announced Monday that they have hired an independent forestry consultant to review their controversial hazard tree removal program. This comes after the state has received allegations of overcutting and mismanagement in their hazardous tree removal program. The consultant, Galen Wright, is based out of Washington State and will spend this week visiting fire-damaged areas of Oregon. So far, the state has marked about half of the 140,000 trees it currently estimates will need to be cut down and removed as a result of large wildfires last year. A deputy administrator at the Oregon Department of Transportation, Mac Lind, told lawmakers on Monday that the project is about a quarter complete and is expected to stretch into late fall. Reports from landowners, former employees, and environmental advocates suggest that the contractor hired by the state to monitor the program, Florida-based CDR McGuire, was inexperienced in this type of work and badly mismanaging it. Their allegations include widespread mismarking and overcutting of non-hazardous trees by unqualified personnel, changing standards for what constitutes a hazard, financial incentives for contractors to cut more, drug use by workers in the field, inadequate safety protocols, and alleged instances of fraud over reported work hours and documentation of trees being cut. Both CDR McGuire and ODOT have said the tree removal program is meticulously designed and trees are evaluated not once, but three times. It is expected that Wright, the independent consultant, will deliver his assessment, including any recommendations, by early June. Just days after Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, passed aggressive public safety reforms, the mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey, says his city is moving to make similar changes. Georgia Fort has more on the story with the Racial Reckoning Project.
The trial for the former Brooklyn Center police officer who shot Dante Wright has been tentatively set for December 6. The former officer, Kimberly Potter, appeared in court Monday afternoon for a pretrial hearing with her attorney, Earl Gray. This after a weekend vote by the city of Brooklyn Center passed a new public safety resolution. Jonathan McClellan, the president of the Minnesota Justice Coalition, says Brooklyn Center is setting an example for cities like Minneapolis by moving so swiftly after Wright's death.
Here we are, 35 days later, Brooklyn Center has taken historic steps to be a beacon of hope and show not only the city, but our whole state of Minnesota and country leadership by example.
Meanwhile, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey says he's moving on public safety issues as well.
We're committed to ending traffic stops solely for low-level offenses, such as small objects hanging from rearview mirrors, inoperable license plate lights, or a busted taillight. Likewise, we intend also to be in coordination with the state of Minnesota around the issue of expired tabs violations, making sure that these are no longer the primary reason for the traffic stop to begin with.
Frey also used this moment to announce another public safety effort. He says he plans to launch new programs to address the city's uptick in gun violence.
This year alone, not even at the halfway point, 19 children have been struck by gunfire. This is not acceptable. This needs to be a turning point right now for our city.
The announcement comes one day after a 9-year-old girl was shot in the head at a birthday party in North Minneapolis. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Georgia Fort.
Critical race theory has become a hot-button issue for conservatives across the country. The theory, which teaches that systemic racism still exists in the U.S., was banned from being taught in Idaho by the state legislature. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Idaho lawmakers were among the first in the country that aimed to ban critical race theory in public schools. Conservatives across the nation have seized on the term over the past year, although the concept has been around since the 1970s. It's a theory underpinned by the idea that systemic racism continues to exist in the United States and impacts opportunities for and treatment of people of color. Adrian Evans with United Vision for Idaho says when diverse groups of students aren't included in the country's collective story, it sends a powerful message about who is and isn't valued.
The ramifications for excluding this kind of truthful, albeit hard, history is deeply disturbing. It has a serious impact on students and children, has a serious impact on how we contextualize the world that we live in.
House Bill 377, which passed this session, withholds funding from public schools and higher education institutions if teachers compel students to adopt or affirm the tenets of critical race theory. Supporters say it inflames divisions among people of different backgrounds. Evans says conservative organizations such as the American Legislative Exchange Council have been leading the charge against critical race theory, noting bills to ban or limit it have been introduced in at least 10 states.
This is a really concentrated, coordinated effort to undermine public education and to cast America as something other than what we are. And that in and of itself is indoctrination.
Evans says the country is doomed to repeat its past sins if it can't come together to understand its history.
We have to speak out loudly that this is not the kind of representation that we need, and it is really deeply harmful to all of us and to our collective future together.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 61 degrees. Today in history, in 1980, at 8:32 a.m., Mount St. Helens erupts in southwestern Washington, killing 57 people and devastating over 200 square miles of wilderness. The force of the eruption was heard from more than 200 miles away. The quote of the day is from Kenyan political activist and the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize, Wangari Maathai, who said, quote, "In a few decades, the relationship between the environment, resources, and conflict may seem almost as obvious as the connection we see today between human rights, democracy, and peace." Israel continues to devastate Gaza with airstrikes, even as calls for a ceasefire are growing. For more on the story, here's KBOO's Al Khan.
Gaza continues to be targeted by Israeli warplanes, as thousands of Palestinians have taken to the streets in protest in cities along the West Bank, including Ramallah and Hebron. Thousands of protesters raise Palestinian flags and burn tires, chanting, "One hand is planting collaborators, another hand is planting freedom. Cover the martyrs with flags, no peace and no surrender." Early Monday morning, shortly after midnight, Israeli warplanes launched a series of deadly airstrikes across Gaza, raining fire at 35 separate sites, claiming that the targets included top Hamas commanders and miles of underground tunnels. Since May 10th, Israeli fighters have savaged over 750 targets in the Gaza Strip, while in the same time period, a little over 3,000 homemade rockets have been fired against Israel, killing 10 people. Meanwhile in Gaza, the death toll has reached over 200, including at least 61 children. During the latest round of hostilities, an Israeli airstrike destroyed a high-rise office building which housed the Associated Press office in Gaza. Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu defended the destruction on CBS's Face the Nation, saying that Hamas's military intelligence was operating inside the building. Another airstrike last Sunday severely damaged a clinic in Gaza City, which housed Gaza's only coronavirus testing facility. Calls for a ceasefire has come from leaders around the globe, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Kim Abdullah of Jordan. And President Biden has now, for the first time, expressed support for a ceasefire. However, he still reiterated that Israel has the right to defend itself. Meanwhile, as rocket fire from Gaza has appeared to slow, Netanyahu said that Israel will continue its strikes on suspected terrorist targets, saying, quote, "We will continue to operate as long as necessary in order to return calm and security to all Israeli citizens," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
The White House response to violence in the Middle East the Supreme Court agrees to hear a case that could upend Roe v. Wade, and COVID-19 cases are down in all 50 states as the push for vaccinations continues. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Every single action we take, every statement we make, is with the objective of reducing the violence and bringing an end to the conflict on the ground.
In a White House briefing on the Israel-Palestine conflict, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the Biden administration is focused on diplomacy in response to questions on why the administration has not joined calls with bipartisan and international partners for a ceasefire. During a joint news conference with Danish Foreign Minister Jeppe Kofod, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. has been working behind the scenes to help bring a resolution to the violence, but maintained Israel has a right to defend itself.
So we call on Hamas and other groups in Gaza to end the rocket attacks immediately.
The U.S. Supreme Court agreed Monday to consider a case that could upend Roe versus Wade. The case involves a 2018 Mississippi law that bans abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Holly Dixon of the Arkansas ACLU says there's been a trend among red states over the past few years to ban the procedure very early in gestation.
We're still fighting several cases that have been filed during previous legislative sessions. Court battles continue. 2015, 2017, 2019 laws.
Now, the latest on the pandemic. In a speech at the White House, President Biden announced COVID-19 cases are down in all 50 states for the first time since the virus began spreading. However, he warns there could be flare-ups in places where not enough people are vaccinated.
We're not done fighting this virus. We still have tens of millions left to vaccinate, but we are making significant progress.
The latest vaccination numbers show around 60% of Americans have received at least one shot. The president also announced the U.S. will send 80 million doses overseas. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair echoed the need to ramp up global vaccinations at a virtual forum held by the Wilson Center.
The U.S. and the U.K. may be vaccinating a lot of people, but it's also in our enlightened self-interest that we vaccinate the strategically vulnerable populations in the world.
And finally, a coalition of 44 state attorneys general are urging Facebook to abandon its plans to launch a version of Instagram for children under age 13. Facebook has said it wouldn't show ads on the Instagram platform, but Tennessee Chief Deputy Attorney General Jonathan Scrimetti says ads or no ads, the platform will be designed to acclimate kids to social media at a time when they're psychologically vulnerable.
And so they're creating consumers, and they're creating consumers who don't recognize that they're going to essentially be commodified by these companies going forward.
A Facebook spokesperson said the company wants to deliver experiences for kids that gives parents visibility and control over what their children are doing. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan. Thanks for listening.
Parents are suing a school district for cutting children's hair. An executive order establishes the next phase of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives Task Force, and the native tourism industry is hit hard by COVID-19. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Lakota couple is suing a Nebraska school district saying their family's traditional Lakota beliefs and practices were violated when their children's hair was cut without permission. The lawsuit was filed Monday by the ACLU of Nebraska. It alleges a Cody Kilgore Unified School employee cut the hair of two elementary students multiple times in the spring of 2020 during head lice checks. According to the lawsuit, this continued even after the family raised concerns. Parents Alice Johnson and Norma Leroy say long hair is part of their culture and religion and should only be cut under specific circumstances by select individuals. The lawsuit argues the school violated the family's First Amendment right to follow their religious beliefs and their constitutional right to due process, and deprived the students of the right to an education free of racial discrimination. The lawsuit is seeking damages. New Mexico's governor recently signed an order to establish the next phase of the state's task force on missing and murdered indigenous women and relatives. The order expands membership of the original task force and brings on new representatives. The task force will work on a state response plan. Christine Means, task force project assistant, says the next phase builds on findings laid out in a report to state officials and lawmakers last year.
The overall goal really is to find that long-term solution, that long-term support of what it is that the task force's role is in the state of New Mexico. What is the role that it plays with tribes, with the New Mexico Indian Affairs Department, with the government of the state of New Mexico? So I think that in the initial year of findings, some recommendations were able to come out of it. And now it's prioritizing those action items and starting to put them into effect so that they can be enacted.
The task force was established in 2019. A final report was released in late 2020 following a series of public meetings and data collection. The executive order allows the task force to continue its work to develop a plan on how to implement the final report's recommendations. The cancellation of the cruise ship season in 2020 due to COVID-19 has impacted Alaska Native communities, which rely on tourism, says the president of the Huna Totem Corporation. Russell Dick testified before the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs last week, saying if they don't see a cruise ship in 2021 in Huna, it will be devastating. He says there are limited economic opportunities in the community, which is not connected to a road system and runs on diesel power. Dick says the cruise ship industry has created jobs and a tax base, contributing millions of dollars to the community.
As we all know, the CDC shut down the cruise industry in the U.S., and to date, it is the only major industry not operating today. In 2020 alone, that shutdown meant the loss of at least 500,000 guests and their economic contributions of nearly $10 million to our community. Icy Strait Point normally employs over 250 people during the season, with nearly 80% local and Alaska Native hire, all in a community of less than 800 people. All of those jobs were non-existent in 2020, and all of those jobs are non-existent today. So it's been over 20 months since Alaska has seen a cruise ship, and our 2021 Alaska cruise season is also in peril, which will continue to devastate the communities throughout Alaska like Huna that depend on tourism.
Dick says a restart to cruising in Alaska is critical, as the season is only 5 months long, May through September. He's seeking federal help, including funding through Native American loan programs and legislative reform to alleviate some restrictions on cruise ships. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
According to Stanford researcher Francis Davenport, the U.S. is already paying the price of a warmer world. Increases in extreme precipitation have cost the U.S. more than $73 billion over three decades. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Torrential rainstorms can flood homes, wash out roads and bridges, and destroy crops. Over the past three decades, flooding from heavy precipitation has caused about $200 billion of damage in the U.S. Frances Davenport is a PhD student in Earth System Science at Stanford University. She wanted to know how much of that enormous price tag can be blamed on global warming.
We've seen that extreme precipitation events are increasing in frequency or intensity, and so we wanted to quantify what are the financial costs of those changes in precipitation.
Her team analyzed historic rainfall trends and financial data about flood damages over decades. They estimated that between 1988 and 2017, about $73 billion of flood damage can be attributed to increases in extreme precipitation. That's more than a third of the cost of flooding over those 30 years. So Davenport says that people are already paying the financial costs of a warming world.
I think having those hard dollar amounts is really important for some of these policy conversations about what to do.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Georgia Fort, Antonia Gonzalez, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO's currently in our spring membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
Making contact. I'm Anita Johnson, and on today's Making Contact.
There's a shirt that MOVE have been selling for years, for decades. It has the helicopter on it, and it says, "Welcome to Philadelphia. Welcome to Philadelphia." And there's a quote on this shirt that says clearly, "This was not an accident. This was deliberate murder. The circumstances surrounding it were horrible, and even more horrible to me was that the perpetrators basically were never in any way punished."
Old wounds were reignited with the acknowledgement that the remains of two children killed in the 1985 MOVE bombing in Philadelphia were being used for research at the University of Pennsylvania and Princeton University without the consent of the family. Mike Africa Jr., a MOVE member and descendant of those murdered in the bombing.
On May 13, 1985, the government dropped the bomb. And they killed 11 people. 11 of my MOVE brothers and sisters. My family members. And when they did that, medical examiners were paid to find out what happened to these dead people. And they took my MOVE family, my brothers and sisters, to a lab. And they left them unrefrigerated. Their bodies were decomposing. And they did such an egregious thing at that point that they were fired and stripped of their license. The people that took over or were supposed to be taking over and continuing this job in an ethical way were the people that we are out here protesting against today. Alan Mann, who is the person, the monster, that has done these horrible things to my sisters. And my question is, where are the rest of the people? Where are the rest of the people? Because you know that if they took Tree and Delisha, they didn't leave the other ones behind. So we are here today, right now, to say that we want to be held accountable for what they did to our family. And we ain't going away. If you know anything about the MOVE organization, you know we can stand our ground. We come back. They drop the bomb on us and it ain't stopped nothing. It ain't stopped nothing. Oh, it hurts. Every time I think about it, it takes me back to 1985. But it ain't stopped nothing! That monster, Janet Mond, is on video describing how my sister probably suffers a fracture because something heavy landed on her.
The two girls, Tree Africa, age 14, and Delisha Africa, age 12, were victims of the Philadelphia police bombing of the Move's home. This horrific attack highlights a painful history of police brutality in the U.S. The most recent discovery that Penn Museum and Princeton's Anthropology Department is using the remains of at least one of the two girls without the consent of their families egregiously displays the dehumanization and disregard for those two little girls and the horror they suffered. On today's show, we'll revisit some of this history with MOVE member and descendant of the victims, Mike Africa Jr., who you'll hear more from later. First, we present the documentary, Let the Fire Burn. The film, directed by Jason Osder, examines the May 13th, 1985 clash between police in Philadelphia and MOVE, a black-led radical environmentalist group.
The fire is now 5 alarms, still raging out of control, as you can see.
Going in, everybody knew that MOVE would resist anything.
While the police will say that they come here to arrest people, we have done nothing wrong.
Did you have a concern that the people in that side of that house might be in physical danger or that their lives might be in danger?
Concern? We knew it. You had 200 boot-kicking, Gestapo-oriented cops out there that day. You had that day a police officer by the name of Mulva Hill, who was in the 1978 tragedy, who was in fact one of the officers who stomped and kicked and beat and bludgeoned and shot and helmeted and kicked some more, my brother, Delbert Africa.
So as I understand your testimony, you were concerned that there may be physical harm to the people inside that house. Is that correct?
Would you turn up your hearing aid, please? And what were we concerned is complete insanity.
Lisa, there has just been a huge explosion here. We don't know what it means, but it just shook the whole place. Debris flew all over the place. I don't know what that explosion was. All I can tell you is that it was a huge blast.
Get a shot with me.
Harvey, can you hear us?
At this point, I really can't tell you very much. There was about a 15-second delay, then an explosion.
Perhaps the most frightening thing here is that police do say that 6 to 8 children are believed to be inside the Move house.
As soon as we find out what the explosion is, we will try to tell you. At this point, I simply do not know.
After the explosion, you saw that the bunker was still there?
Yes, sir.
Did you observe any smoke or fire on the roof?
I did not.
And
I did hear over the radio that there was none. I wanted to get the bunker. I wanted to be able to somehow have tactical superiority without sacrificing any lives, if it were at all possible.
Commissioner Sambor said to me, he said, let's let the bunker burn. To eliminate that high ground advantage and the tactical advantage of the bunker, and I said, yeah, okay.
It was not an order. In essence, in communication, I communicated to him that I would like to let the fire burn.
If you look carefully, by the way, if you can take a look so I can point to the monitor here, right here is a line of stakeout squad officers, and they seem to be lined up at the ready waiting for something to happen. They seem to be waiting for something to come out of that house.
Now, when they did come out, I see the smaller child come out, and then an adult male come out right behind him.
Yeah.
And he stood up and aimed a rifle up in the direction of Officer Barriana's position and fired like 4 or 5 quick shots.
Did Conrad have a rifle or a gun when he went out to the garage door?
Mm-mm.
What did he use to open the bolt on the door?
A big monkey wrench.
A big monkey wrench?
Are you certain it was a rifle and not a monkey wrench or something of that nature?
I know a rifle, believe me. When this male pointed this rifle up, in other words, I could hear sound, I could see muzzle flashes.
Now, you say that some shooting started. Could you hear shooting?
It was like it was just going after each other. Like it was going, both were going after each other. Like
both were going, one right after something like that?
Yeah.
Sergeant Griffith, could you just by rapping on the table indicate the sound, the best you can recall of those shots?
It was not automatic fire, if that's what you're asking.
Okay, could you just try and indicate for me what it sounded like?
Did you ever fire your weapons after the bomb was dropped, Officer Mulvihill?
No, sir.
Officer DeLisi?
No, sir.
He had some officers taking him out, and then they started shooting again, and then they brought him back in, then they locked the thing back up.
Do you have any idea why that person may have gone back into the fire?
My own idea? What I think?
Yes.
I just think they went back into that fire, sort of to regroup.
Well, just as a human being myself, I'm just trying to imagine myself in that situation. And behind me, there's a raging inferno. And in front of me, there are people who are saying, come on out. I'm trying to imagine what would cause me to turn back and run into the fire.
I don't think we said anything other than come down to us. Come on down with your hands up. Normal police jargon.
I'm just saying that I'm trying to put myself in that person's skin.
So I don't think you ever could. Well, move members.
Well, you see, I knew a lot of those people as individuals and as human beings. A lot of people know move from what they may have seen. But I'd had a lot of dealings with them, and I knew them to be more than move people. I knew many of them by name as human beings. It's probably a rhetorical question. I don't think you, from the way you've responded, I don't think you can answer that.
No, sir.
That's audio from the 2013 film, Let the Fire Burn, documenting the police bombing of a home occupied by MOVE members. After the break, we go to recent protests from MOVE members who learned the remains of one of the bombing victims is being used in anthropology classes at the University of Pennsylvania and Princeton University. We want to hear your thoughts on recent developments. Tweet us at @making_contact or message us on Instagram at Making Contact Radio Project. That's all one word. You can also write us at makingcontact@radioproject.org. On April 26th, the University of Pennsylvania and Princeton University apologized to the Africa family for using the remains of one of the MOVE bombing victims, 14-year-old Tree Africa, as a case study in his anthropology classes without the knowledge of the family. In response, members of MOVE, a Philadelphia-based radical organization, rejected the apology and accused the city, Penn Museum, and Princeton University of mishandling and disrespecting the remains of their family members who died in the 1985 bombing that killed 11 people, most of whom were children. On April 28th, 2021, MOVE and community members gathered in front of Penn Museum and the home of UPenn's president to protest and demand the remains be returned. Mike Africa Jr.
So when I think about what has happened, what these people have done to them, it is unfathomable. And the other day, as Chris and I were going through these forms and this investigation stuff, trying to figure out and trying to get to the root of this, who would do this, who did this, why did they do this? One of the things that was in those documents was Tree's birth certificate. And when I looked at the birth certificate, I saw her footprints. And I saw her birth date. And at the time, when we were kids, we didn't celebrate birthdays. We didn't do that. You know, if we needed something, our rules were if you need something, you get it. You don't wait till a day to tell you that you need something. You just get what you need when you need it. But when I looked at her birth date, I never knew that it was the same day as mine. And it was just so striking. And even though that doesn't really matter, it feels like a stronger connection. And when I think about Alicia and her sister Yvonne, just read the statement, Chris read the statement from Yvonne, her sister, who she never really got to really know, it is such a tragedy. And it makes me so determined, so confident that we are going to bring accountability to these people who did this to our people. I don't care how much time it takes, and I don't care what it takes. All right, let's bring it back.
So, for people who don't know where we are physically on Pence campus, right behind us is the president's house.
Dr. Crystal Strong, an assistant professor of education at UPenn.
And part of the intention of coming to this place is that in the response that we've seen so far, there have been sidesteps, half-truths, mischaracterizations, falsehoods, shallow apologies that were not delivered to the MOVE family, but that were sent through the media and on email blast, but not directly to MOVE members. And so I hope you all feel how palpable, how present the pain is for members of the MOVE family who are having to relive all of these traumas anew, with new traumas on top of that, so close to the anniversary of May 13th. This is the first year after the city's so-called apology, and we see that we haven't even uncovered all of the harms, all of the violences. And so we really wanted to share with you that they were human beings who had lives and dreams and loves and loved ones. And I don't know, there was a story you shared that you, when we were getting ready for today, you really wanted to tell this story. I don't know if you still want to tell the snow story.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to. But you specifically said, don't let me not tell the snow story. So.
All right. Yeah. So, all right, this is what Chris talking about. So y'all know when we was kids, we used to run around naked all the time, even in the winter. We were strong, you know. So Tommaso was, you know, one of the kids. And he and I were, we were crying about something. My grandmother was about to leave the house, and we wanted to go with her. And she, for whatever reason, she couldn't take us with her. So to make us feel better about not being able to go with her, she told us that it was going to snow that day. So we happy. Tommaso used to do this thing where he would run in a circle when he was happy. He would run in a circle, his arms be swinging, and he'd be just going, right? So he had a big stomach, right? And I used to say to him all the time, did you swallow a whole watermelon? And, you know, we had this thing. But anyway, it was snowing, or it didn't snow yet. So we looking outside. It didn't look like it was going to snow. It looked like a regular day, like right now. And so we sitting in the window. We hopped up on the windowsill, and we just kind of back to back, just waiting for the snow to fall. Looking out the window, we don't see no snow. We sat there so long, we fell asleep. I don't know how much time passed. You know, when you're a kid, time is different. We fell asleep, and when we woke up, there was snow everywhere. It was, we couldn't see anything. We couldn't see the street. We couldn't see the cars. We didn't see anything. So we looked at each other. We hopped down. Snow. We look. He opens the front door, and we're looking outside at the snow. And we're naked. No clothes. My man ran outside and jumped in the snow. He started throwing it up on himself and covering himself in snow. He was white, half white, right? So his body turned red, like, immediately. And he just, like, now he's just sitting there looking like. And I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, nah, I ain't doing that. I ran upstairs, and I put some clothes on. And then I ran outside. When I got down the steps, he was still out there in the snow. So I ran out there and I joined him, and I'm in the snow, and we playing, and we just throwing snow up in the air on top of each other. The other kids were there too. They said the same thing that I said. Nah, I ain't going out there with no clothes on. Tommaso, he could really take the cold well. And so we played so much, we our clothes got sweaty and wet, and we took them off, we throw them down, and we put some new clothes on. Tommaso put some clothes on. We went back outside, and we played until those clothes were soaking wet, too. And the other kids, they were doing something. They didn't really hang out with us as much. We were younger than they were. You know, when you're a kid, 2 years is a lot, right? Not nowadays. You're 40 and 42? That don't mean nothing. But back then, it means something. So we got in the house. By the time we were done playing in the snow, Grandma was home. We had a pile of clothes mounded over on the floor. She came in the house, and she looked at us and just shook her head and chuckled and was like, what did y'all do? And Tree, the oldest, what did she do? Immediately, Grandma started picking up clothes and gathering them up to take them to the laundry, and Tree just instinctively, willingly, without hesitation, helped her do it. And she was smiling the whole time, telling on us, telling them, they did this and they did that. They, you know, gathering everything up. That's one of the vivid memories I have. I have a lot of memories, but they're not really clear because I was so young. But that one, I really, really remember that one. We had such a good time, and it was one of the last times I saw them. That's the story.
So I think it's really beautiful and poignant that we can laugh and smile in just taking in the memories and of the lives of Delisha and Tree and the other children who were killed on May 13th, 1985, alongside our tears, alongside our rage. But we don't forget that rage is real. The need for justice is real. The demand for justice is real. And so, one thing that I have found so despicable about the media coverage is that it is centering the doers of the harm, as opposed to the people who have been harmed. That's right. I don't know about what an apology means and looks like to you, but I'm not trying to hear about your apology from somebody else. I'm not trying to hear about your apology until you've come to see me. Ask me what I want, what it would look like for you to repair harm, if repair of harm is even possible. And so, as a way of kind of closing today, which has been a beautiful day, a beautiful coming together in honor of Delisha and Tree Africa, organized by the people who love them. And so we want to hold space to hear what might it look like to honor Delisha and Tree Africa. Not for the media, not for the PR, but in a true transformative and reparative sense, if that is even possible in the first place.
Yeah, somebody said take down that sign.
Okay.
That Wilson Good street sign, the person who was the mayor that cooperated, that worked with the city police and the state and the military government to drop a bomb on our house. The fact that my sisters are in a laboratory being experimented on and he has a sign, that's one thing that could be done. There's other things that can be done. First of all, let me just say, make no mistake about it, there's nothing that can be done to fix anything, that can repair anything. Can't bring them back. I mentioned that sign because Mama Maisha, who lives not far from that sign, she has to pass that sign regularly. It's a reminder. But as to how we're going to move forward with this and our strategy, we are assembling a team. We're building a team of strategic-minded people. And we're going to come up with a strategy. And we're going to figure out what the next steps looks like. And we are going to let you know. And we're going to need your help. We're going to need to add extreme pressure. John Africa said the system is controlled by pressure. And you got to keep the pressure on. And we're going to need your help. Going to need their help. So as we move forward, look out for updates. We got a lot of people that are wanting to talk about this because we got families of other victims. Let's not forget Henrietta Lacks. Right? I just talked to a person. My email has been flooded with people who are complaining about the same type of stuff. I got so many phone calls from people who remember and was a part of and are still suffering today because of what was done at Holmesburg Prison. Acres of skin. And those people were experimented on by doctors from the University of Pennsylvania. So we are going to assemble this team, this crew, this network of organizations and legal people, legal strategists. We're going to figure this out. So if Dr. Alan Mann really believed what he said when he made that quote, that the people, the perpetrators, were never in any way punished, I'm glad he said that. Because if they, what they should do is expect the type of justice that they would want to see if this was done to their families. Right? That's where we at. And one more thing, just so let's make it clear. Like I said earlier, Delisha and Tree were two. There were 11 people that were murdered. John Africa was my great uncle. Frank Africa was my cousin. And all the other people were my move brothers and sisters. And there's a lot of connections to those people from other people who might not at this point know about this. But when they find out, I can expect them to feel like I feel. So this thing, we can expect to see this thing mushroom.
You've been listening to Making Contact. This audio is courtesy of Hate 56. It's from a recent protest in Philadelphia in front of the Penn Museum and the home of UPenn's president. For a full list of credits, speakers, and more information about the 1985 bombing of MOVE and the horrific acts of Penn Museum and Princeton's Anthropology Department, please visit our website at radioproject.org. I'm Anita Johnson. Thank you for listening to Making Contact.
Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned natural foods cooperative featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a farmer's market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbet Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.